Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Amber Data Podcast. I'm here with Yo Turpin, who is the co-founder of Wintermute. Yo, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Good to meet you. I think it's the first time we meet, actually. I may have a cross path, actually, over conferences, but I don't think we've ever done this before, so I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it is the first time we meet. I'm really excited. You have quite an extensive background, all the way from trading to investing to co-founding. There's really some good topics here. So I would like to maybe just kind of start with your background, and then we could go into the Wintermute side of the business. But kind of starting with your background, you know, how did you start in school, and how did you kind of start your career? And maybe we can dig into some of those points.
So you mentioned school, so it depends. The question usually is like, how far do you want to go? Essentially, school. The one thing I like to mention is that my older sister taught me some math really early on. She wanted to be a teacher, and basically, I was the guinea pig when I was 3-4, and I just made it really easy to go through school, especially primary and junior high school. So I like math and like problem solving in general. And then I went through, essentially I wanted something a lot wider than some of the scientific track that you have in France. So you have scientific track, like economics and just like literary tracks in France. And I went for an economics track because I could do the math, I could do the economics, I could do still leverage languages. I love to learn languages and so on and practice them. So I did that, went through business school, but essentially part of school, and I kind of ignored school in some way because I had half of my family are educators. And you kind of get respect and disrespect for teachers when they're part of your family, kind of like, you know, why, like, they don't know more than we know, kind of thing. So I tended to be a bit critical of this, and liked to be quite self-taught from the start. I think my parents, especially my dad, really helped on that front, just essentially letting me manage the stock portfolio at 12.
Oh wow!
And that was much more my education. We didn't have internet; we had the Minitel at the time, and then we had through the French like local newspaper as such. There was a bit of an investment guide with the Monnaie Patif, you know, the French derivatives markets from the 80s, essentially. I got my hands on, so basically bought this when I was 15 and started to trade basically warrants at the time, because you couldn't trade options per se. And at 18, my other education is sort of part of business school. Basically, the first internship that I did was essentially to trade on Boursorama at the time. So basically trade on a retail brokerage account, but trade futures. And you needed a letter to be a certified investor at the time, or certified trader or a sophisticated investor, essentially. And I got someone to actually sign this up when I was about 18 to go and trade CAC 40 futures. I didn't really make much money out of it. I didn't really lose much money out of it either. But I just spent a bit of fees and just basically learned that it was actually just pretty hard to trade deltas. So by the means of trading deltas to trade directionally, it was actually pretty hard. I was trading on pretty low time frames. Made some money on some stocks as well. So I traded some Eurotunnel and stuff. So a lot of French stocks that were just, had really big tick sizes, and essentially traded some kind of quality futures. But that was probably more of my education than actually what I learned at school.
Yeah, it's super interesting.
And then the last big piece of education was to start, as a trader at Optiva. I think you know some of that. But essentially started, so 3rd of April 2006 at Optiva, and then spent 4 years there. And it's a bit of a, you know, baptism of fire to stay in these shops and to survive there. To be selected is already a big thing. But, and this is why I met, Evgeny the first time.
Oh, that's very interesting. So you actually you were like already a trader early on in your early teens, it sounds like. And then you kind of already had that vision. So once you kind of finished the schooling program, you went to Optiver. I saw you also did a stint at Societe Generale on the FTX OTC desk. Is that right?
Yeah. So I did that as my gap year. So a lot of French banks do this, where you just basically paid as a trainee, but you do a senior sales leader job.
How
So
interesting.
essentially, you make that millions, but you're paid 1,200 euros a month, which
Wow.
honestly, as an intern, is not bad to be paid 1,200 euros a month. But it's just a bit, I was a bit disenchanted, basically, like when I was suggested to take another internship afterwards. I just told them, no, listen, I just gonna find a
That's
job,
pretty
and
interesting.
I had the offer for up to the few days before finishing my master's anyway. But it was, so that stint as a sales trader was really interesting for a few different dimensions, or three dimensions, I would say. One, like from a financial, I know you've been a trader as such as well. So I think in terms of financial knowledge, like, we would trade very complex things. I think they would get away with a lot of margin just because no one else could price this in the market. So it was
Oh, wow.
2004, and they would price, strips of calls up and in, and different barriers, and do like loads of FX hedging. So imagine your company that, borrows yen, dollars, and so on, and that you're a European company that does this, and then you need to hedge interest, you need to hedge, different principal repayments and so on. So actually, we would build products to do that. So I think what was interesting from working for that bank was that, getting some respect for, like, essentially these quant, more quants than traders, who are very good at pricing these exotics. I had some interesting, like, realization, I would say, of, like, it even, it's good CFOs that have spent like 5 years at a company actually still struggle a bit. And like, you only find like a few CFOs who can just generally fully understand
Oh,
those products,
interesting.
though. So it would take a lot of education, a lot of time to educate people on the financial side. One thing, the one third dimension that I really didn't like was the way that we were asked to sell those products. So basically, I didn't like the fact that essentially it's pitched as a, oh, you put on this position for free, but essentially most of the gamma, most of the theta just gets captured by the bank, and essentially the customer, like, misses a lot of, like, it's not, it wasn't actually, at the time, it wasn't a very efficient execution. I think nowadays it's a lot more transparent. There's pretty good standards of how much, the percentage of the premium is taken as margin and so on. But at
Yeah.
the time, I really didn't like it. So I was really eager to just move into trading and not be in a position where I didn't like the ethics of the job. Nothing was illegal, but didn't like how they were doing business. So I was very
Yeah.
happy to move into trading.
That makes a lot of sense. So if I can just kind of re-say that for my own understanding. So basically you have a bunch of kind of price insensitive commercial hedgers that have businesses overseas. They need to hedge some FX cash flows. The OTC desk can essentially price something that makes sense for their particular unique need, but embedded within the structured product, there's kind of a nice spread in terms of vol and potential gamma profiles that you can hedge against. And therefore, it's more of a flow gate. You're not really making bets on volatility necessarily or direction. You're essentially taking counterparty flow and making a kind of a small spread or a pretty good spread, and then hedging that out and taking no kind of delta risk. And it's more of a game of getting more customers to essentially ask for some of that flow. Is that kind of the idea?
Exactly. And then the positives of it are very much that you can, thanks to the exotics, you can actually fit any scenario that the customer has in mind, to be honest. Like, you can just really think, oh, I mean, you put this in a BTC context, like, people want to think of, like, oh, by the end of this year, I think, like, we're never going to see 100,000, but, like, we're somehow going to land at 90,000. And, you can build these things with barriers. You can build these things with, it doesn't have to be very complex, but you can really build a product that fits someone's expectations, essentially.
Yeah,
You regardless of how precise it may be.
that's fascinating. And then on the Optifer side, what was kind of that trading experience like? Was it more of a traditional like listed market making type of experience where you're managing that type of risk, or was it also a structured product OTC type of scenario?
So it was more OTC, but it wasn't structured as such. So it was still listed products as such, or very much ETPs, as some call them. It was very interesting in a way that what I was doing over there. So essentially started as a market maker per se in rates. and then built some arbitrage desk on a, what's called Model Long End, so essentially interest rates in Germany. Then I moved into co-building an arbitrage desk between the US and Europe, which is actually fairly like much better known strategy, but actually in 2006, 7, 8, it wasn't that well covered, I would say. And it was really interesting because it was much more like a macro hedge fund kind of strategy than really something that really was core to a company like Optiver. Like a company like Optiver just makes markets, especially in options, but I mean, it's changed over the last 15 years again. But essentially they tend to make money on flow, but not necessarily on taking positions. And what I was doing at the time was pretty much 95% of the money was made taking positions.
Oh, wow.
So listening to central bankers and trying to understand what a Greenspan, what a Trichet and so on would say, and how, you know, filling in the bingo card and then seeing how that would impact the markets and how I think they would impact the markets. Is there mispricing based on this? And so on. And then just essentially just putting up positions, purely vol positions, nothing directional. So we did really well, you know, 6,000, you know, 6, 7, 8. We were still doing very well in 2009. Well, I don't know if you were trading at the time and so on, but essentially 2009 was actually pretty tough business for actually most of the prop trading firms because actually volumes were down, or at least things were a bit too directional. So especially the equity market just went up straight, and it's actually very difficult like markets for prop firms. But we did really well. And in a bit, like, I was starting to feel that essentially the company had grown to a stage where, you know, I wanted to either, well, essentially the backstory was that 2 years in, I was promised a partnership, you know, if I had achieved XYZ, and then 4 years in, I had achieved XYZ, and then the partnership was still there, was still not there. And
No.
essentially, the company had grown to a certain degree where I could have stayed in, got that partnership like maybe 3, 4 years later, but I had the opportunity to just build my own thing essentially in between. So I had to sit, like you've gone through, I'm assuming a few times, but, you know, sit through a non-compete and then build my first company, in 2011.
Oh yeah, that's really interesting, 'cause like that type of global macro prop trading, I mean, it takes a really skilled trader to essentially be able to manage that risk, take smart trades, be consistently profitable. Pretty frustrating to do all those things and it kind of get the partnership ripped out from under you. That's too bad. But that actually led you to start a couple companies, and then finally you co-founded Wintermute most recently, and you were actually the head trader of Wintermute for a long time. Maybe we can just dig into that. What got you into crypto? Why did you decide to co-found Wintermute? How did that come about?
So I'll tell you a bit more about the previous businesses to
Sure.
tell you why I went to meet. So
Perfect.
the first business was essentially not very infrastructure dependent. So a lot of trading businesses tend to be very heavily infrastructure dependent, very tech dependent. So essentially the first business was very much taking positions and so similar to what I was doing at Optiver, just taking positions as central bankers and so on. But got a few misalignments with investors there where I was there to build a company and they were there to very much be allocators, be kind of like hedge fund allocators. So I didn't like that short-term versus long-term, you know, gap, the dichotomy there. And I found that was misaligned as such. And it's always in these trading partnerships, it's always very difficult to see where the IP sits and so on. So that was one of the learnings I think is useful to mention. During that time still, I had some exits out of that company, but also I had put some of my first the first big bonus from Optiver. I had used it to actually make private, you know, private investments as such, and non-listed company investments, more pre-IPO type of investments. But then through, you know, we went through a bit of history on the school, went through business school, and then the French business school I did. One of my two flatmates, one of them was an entrepreneur. Like he's very much a serial entrepreneur already at the time. So essentially 2012, I started to co-invest with him in France and then started to do a lot more angel investing. So post exiting and basically the first company in 2014, it wasn't like a huge exit. It was more house money and not necessarily retirement money, but enough to just go and invest and deploy. And I started to continue to invest, and that formed other companies where I was I had about 14 angel investments, and basically I started to see, no, it was just not, it wasn't a feel, it was just a very blunt observation that I was better at fundraising than most of the CEOs that I was investing in. I had both a better network, and maybe just not being inside the company all the time just helps you to actually pitch and phrase things better. You can stay higher level. You don't have to, I think a lot of people who build their own companies just lose themselves in the details. They just want to tell you what they do every day, and it's not what matters. So I built the second company was much more around helping others to pitch and doing a bit of hedge fund due diligence and so on with my experience. And also there's a third company before Wintermute where essentially I co-built a venture studio that turned into its own thing, more of a workforce platform. I think a lot of the good venture studios actually do end up, building a certain amount of knowledge and turning into their own company as such. And seeing all the difficulty of, I don't know if you've ever dealt with venture studios, but seeing all the difficulty of finding CEOs. You can build products pretty easily, but then just finding other people to take over those products and grow them is very, very difficult. But out of these three companies, I think one big experience I've had, I would say two things. One is the first one did the best because it was with also ex-colleagues from Optiva. So I think there was a big amount of filtering. So I was keen to actually just start something else with ex-Optivas. And the inception on my side, or the impetus, if you want, was that I was going back into trading 2016, 17. And I was reviewing essentially reviewed about 56 ICOs with someone who was also the model with hedge fund hotels. I mean, I think what did you do? You did Chopper and DRW before. So these silos. Some of the people are just, and you can have like pretty flexible hedge fund hotels where you essentially bring your own money, and you have pretty good access to a clearer essentially. Because it's actually quite expensive to build up your own firm if you wanted to. And while I was doing this, I was sitting next to an ex-Marshall Wace who was all over crypto. Because of my past as a more macro, like hedge fund manager in a type of trader, I had said no to crypto twice because I had listened to central bankers too much, essentially. And I was thinking, it's like, oh no, it's never going to fly. Sadly, at the time, I had not read the Bitcoin white paper, so I didn't really know that, they couldn't do anything about it. But essentially, I had said no to Bitcoin in 2012 and 15. But then in 2017, I was essentially offered to manage a sleeve, a macro hedge fund sleeve that would be just a crypto dedicated sleeve. And then I realized, I'm not the best coder. I've known this for some time, so I needed someone like more like a CTO or so who became, and then another trader because, someone gets sick, someone like,
Course.
you need to cover trading. And then, just exchanging thoughts on this with another ex-Optiva, a French friend actually who lives in the US. He recommended me to reconnect with Yevgeny, who had just moved to London at the time, and I had been in London for about 7 to 8 years at the time. So I reconnected with Yevgeny. I thought initially that I would just do some angel co-investing and so on at the time, and then Yevgeny just had just set up Wintermute, and he asked me to just join in as a co-founder. And essentially, what I did is I took Yevgeny and Harold out of the garage and organized the first few rounds of funding. And I think just going back full circle on the first role, my first role is a bit of a misstatement. It's much more because there was no framework. You still today, you don't really have any prime broker in the crypto space. So essentially what you need to do if you start trading, well, you need to aggregate all the capital. You need to do the connecting with exchanges. And the connecting and exchanges ended up to be much more of a developer's work. So we ended up, hiring a lot of devs at the start. And then the rest was essentially done by me and our first employee was about to raise the first few rounds of equity, and then connect with exchanges. So you actually needed to pitch into exchanges to make sure that exchanges understood that we would be big, that we needed to prove it, and then we needed to be put on appropriate fee schedules to be able to do that. And actually, we spent the first 2+ years really building a lot of the tech. I think we only got the first $400,000 of loan to trade on the 6th of August 2019. So you can imagine it's just like it's pretty much 2 years in. And that was the first time so we could really accumulate, a bit more training revenues. And at the time, I think 2019, I think 80% of the money we were making was just going into exchange fee.
Oh, wow.
And I think you probably remember from your time in prop tradings that, I mean, my rule of thumb, I don't know what your rule of thumb is, but my rule of thumb is about if a third of your money goes into fees, if you're prop trading a third of your money, it goes into fees and you're high frequency enough, you can pay your bills. But if it's above that, it just gets pretty tricky. So it's just a bit. So 80% was really, really quite a
Yeah, that's really
lot.
interesting. That's really interesting. We never really think about that, when we're dealing with TradFi or we're working at a prop shop or a hedge fund. We have the prime broker's balance sheet that we can use to essentially make trades and stuff like that. Crypto doesn't have that, so you essentially got to round up all your capital, which capital raising is an extremely valuable skill for sure. And then you got to connect to all these exchanges that might not have standard API kits and stuff like that, write your own tech to do market making. And yeah, the crypto fees are larger in the crypto space than in the TradFi space. And so there's a big negotiation, it sounds like a big negotiation part as part of the business to essentially allow you to capture your own revenue. Even though the spreads might be bigger, it still adds up. That's really interesting. What kind of str Go ahead.
I think it brings into, I mean, maybe you're going on to this, but I think it brings into why we structured this that way, why we have a lot of OTC, borrowing, why we have a lot of OTC, I think both on from an institutional point of view or from, borrowing directly from foundation, and also why we very brand and, BD focused as such in that way, even if we don't. I mean, we're very much tech driven. We have, we have a lot less BD than most competitors. But still brand and rep let's call it that brand and reputation is still everything. Because it only the product only shines if people know about it as well. So and all of this is just a reflection of, we needed to and we still need today just to aggregate our own capital. And and get access to the right pools of liquidity and so on. So you have to do a lot of the integrations yourself. You have to do a lot of the capital aggregation yourself. And yeah, sorry, just go and ask your question.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And so early on in the early days of the Wintermute sort of strategies, what kind of strategies were you guys looking at? Was it just liquidity providing and perps and options on various venues? Or was it something else? And how has the strategy sort of complex expanded today? Like, do you have more business lines and more sort of strategies that you guys pursue?
So we have many more business lines per se. I think the inception was, and you all understand why I made that point about my first venture, is that I really insisted on us, being essentially a share company, and then us getting VC money as opposed to fund managers and so on to avoid it, to accumulate some of the learnings from the first company where we didn't have good alignment of interest. And that meant that with VC investors, we had essentially, and it was easier to build for tech, and two, it was easier to hire the right people with the right mindset. But also that turned out to be much more about us than having the opportunity to have the time to essentially invest in DeFi as such. So we started. We're not technically the first. I think we were second to trade on DYDX in August 2019, and that gave us a lot of differentiation because essentially we were focused on spot. As a former derivatives trader, I really wanted us to trade derivatives from like 2019, but actually even the hires we made in 2019, 2020 for as option traders per se, they all ended up learning spot and then basically just trading over, the DeFi summer of 2020. And they're just all, and then actually, even so, if you think about the product deployment, also, or like what we were trading, like for the first 2 3 years of Wintermute, it was very spot heavy, very very spot heavy. So we do about 10 to 15% of total spot volumes
Oh,
nowadays.
wow.
So we've really really built that side of the business, and a lot of the differentiation happened to be, good synergies between the CeFi and the DeFi side of the business. And then you need a scale. You've heard this more than one time, but you need scale for these businesses. And I think people do well if you're in the top 2 to 3, essentially. So there's a big advantage. You never want to have, 100% market share. It doesn't work like this. I think it tends to cap around 20, 25%, especially if you really, really stay, you really stay really market neutral, and we're just very market neutral. So we're still heavily a spot business. We're growing the derivatives business very fast, but it's like anywhere between first and fifth in the world, essentially.
Oh, wow.
What I learned also from trading interest rates, I don't remember reading actually what products you traded, but actually interest rates were very, very OTC heavy. So like 90-95% of the volumes are OTC, and a lot of the price discovery happens OTC. And we start to see this shift in our business, where I think in May or so we traded. So there's a few elements to it. There's one element that's a very long-term element, where we want to be able to cover institutions. And actually the first one of the rationale, and the first seed, seed ACB for Intermute was like, oh, when BlackRock has, what, X percent of their assets in crypto, we're golden, and we're just preparing for this. So we are discussing, it's quite funny that now they have an ETF and so on, because that was 2017, 18, well, more 2018, was pitching, pitching that, imagine BlackRock, X trillions of dollars under management, is X amount that goes into crypto. Because for me, from a macro point of view, it made a ton of sense that, this is an asset class that's uncorrelated, and something people wouldn't understand. At some point, people wouldn't understand the addition to the whole, palette of assets. And it's interesting to see that from institutional point of view, like, yeah, we've even on the CME. Well, I think there's a few of these banks that trade crypto. Like, I think Goldman Sachs can only trade there. Because, I mean, a lot of these banks essentially can't cover the underlying asset, so you have to go through derivatives. So it's a good part of the adoption to actually just go through derivatives, and just give people a delta and exposure, I should say, to the crypto space through that. So the CME is one that we're pretty happy to cover now. That's very different from, trading in DeFi. OTC point of view, in terms of percentages of the business, I think we've had days in early March. I think it's the 5th of March, where we traded nearly $3 billion.
Oh, wow.
And it's much bigger than what our biggest days of 2021 were for OTC. So I think if, big day in 2021, we traded, let's say, about 20 to 25 billion. At most, 1 billion of that would be OTC. And then you just see a shift in actually the nature of the volume, or also in the quality of the volume. Well, there's definitely some more education from, various, market participants, but essentially, like the OTC portion of the business used to be like, let's call it 5% of the total volumes, about 3 years ago. And then now it's more like going into the 20, 15, 20, some days, 25% of the business. DeFi, to my disappointment, doesn't change. It just scales exactly like the same. It just stays the same percentage. It scales with the rest of the ecosystem. I think there's a few reasons why it's still there, but yeah, essentially, like, DeFi users are basically kind of like 1-1.5% of like the total users.
Oh, interesting. Is that true for spot DeFi as well?
I'm assuming it's spot DeFi numbers. I think it's just total user numbers.
I see. Oh, total
even
users.
though, even though it's a good question, I don't know the granularity actually, because the perp, sort of the derivatives, like the Vertex and so on, the Brisbane of the world have been quite popular recently. So maybe there will be more adoption. A lot of these are, I don't know if they're fully considered DeFi though. Because a lot of these have like, you know, hybrid order books and so on, they're sort of defined T5, C5 plays. It's a good question if it's if it helps. I think the reality is that C5 is the door, is the adoption channel. And people tend to go through like C5 first and then go to D5 once they know a bit more of the tech, when they get more confident to just, you know, do their own custody, once they get confident to just, you know, send funds to lend or to trade on chain. So I think it's part of the equation. And yeah, there's still a lot of things that you can't really do online. So, I mean, on chain. So I'm not surprised that, that C5, you know, tends to win still. Go ahead.
It's interesting that the OTC flow has grown so much. In my mind, OTC customers are sort of a good proxy for more institutional-like customers. I don't know if you would agree with that or disagree with that. Whereas the DeFi clientele is more of like the crypto native sort of OG investors in 2014, 2015, 2016, kind of that class. Do you think the growth in OTC flows signifies like a growth of sort of institutional clients starting to trade crypto?
I think some of it is, some of it is not. Some of it is, and in terms of like, because you see this through like crossing venues, like, you know, typically I mentioned us crossing on the CME nowadays. That's definitely one aspect. But like some of it is not, where I think it's the nature of volumes have grown, but actually venues or the granularity or the segregation of different platforms across, you know, the flow of across different platforms has also grown. So it's more if you go through, if you go on chain, or if you go through CeFi, essentially, you'll have smaller blocks, smaller trades as such. And then I think if you want to trade larger sizes, you just have to go OTC nowadays.
I see.
You know, so I think it's also that aspect.
Yeah, interesting.
So yeah, I think that's the aspect. And I think there's, for good reasons, there's, well, let's say post FTX especially, there's been a flip in like relationships between, let's say, once before you were as a counterparty, you as a trading firm or so, you had to show a lot to exchanges to be able to trade there. And post FTX essentially it's kind of a reverse as such, like the it's more about, it's as much, if you're going to put a lot of money on exchanges, you need to know a lot of the financials and so on. If people don't share financials, then you tend to leave very little money on there. And then it means, I think it's probably pushed like a lot more granularity in terms of, well, it's distributed the flow of trading across many, many more venues, I think.
I see what you're saying. So yeah, so the link of trust on an exchange has sort of been broken post FTX. So now it's a lot more trustworthy to do some flows OTC with counterparties that don't necessarily have the exchange risk that we didn't know existed pre-FTX.
Yeah, and I think the timing is interesting as well. So I think it's in 2022. I don't want to say, I think it's in early 2022 that we got our FC registration as well.
Oh, cool.
I remember 26th of Feb, but I think it's 2022. We can check that with my team later. But essentially it's just only revolves around AML and CTF. But it's interesting things that, okay, people like us may actually be much more regulated than actually some exchanges, than some of the, especially the unregulated ones. When we don't do any custody, when we don't do it, you know, so there's many elements that are interesting. That I'm not saying that being regulated is just a carte blanche for everything either, but I think it just rebalances maybe the picture on, like, I think, you know, on like, who can you trust essentially, and who do you want to do business with? But yeah, you're correct.
That makes a lot of sense. And so speaking of FTX, and we actually had like a lot of bull cycles, and we had the COVID flash crash, we had the massive rally in Q4 2020 to 2021, we had the FTX scenario. How did you navigate all those situations? Was there any points in time where it felt like, oh, this is kind of like a crazy moment? Is there, or was it kind of smooth business as usual through all those scenarios?
I don't necessarily like it, smooth business as usual. I mean, it's just, I think what I've tend to do, I mean, tend to do well, especially from the trading point of view, like in difficult years. Like the first year I had, that 2008 for strange reasons. I mean, for some, because of the way Optiver traded, and then the way that we did the company did really, really well in 2008. And that was my best year for many, many years. My first business 2011, we navigated a tsunami, we navigated a Greek vote in June 2011. We navigated the whole Greek crisis after this in September and dislocations between US and Europe. And we returned 162%.
Wow.
So it's more like exceptional things I tend to do better with. To be honest, the first time we realized we were really, really onto something with Wintermute, and I'm pretty sure we're in agreement with this with Yevgeny, because we did one of the rare podcasts we did together. We pointed to the same event, which is essentially, you probably remember the dip during COVID, the early COVID,
Right, down to
when
five
actually
thousand.
BTC, BTC like down even 3,800. I think that was below. So essentially down 40, 45% or so, like in one day. And we returned, that was the first six figure day for us. It was like, oh, okay, something actually like worked or so. Because essentially when you're market neutral, you're not like, back on the capital basis we had it, we're not necessarily make that much money. And I think it's more like, the infrastructure is robust. Like we didn't get taken offside, essentially. We didn't get taken, like we didn't really get the wrong trade. We got the right trades and made a bit more money than we expected. So I think it's just good to see. So I think it's more like one thing. So I mean, you want two things in a trading company as such, and going back to strategies, that like you want things to be really reliable and you want things to be really scalable. That sort of event just really shows reliability and some amount of scalability. And I know if you just scalability is more about the size of the market nowadays and then how many business units we can add. But essentially that was a really good first time. So that was one of the dips in 2020.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially from a trading firm perspective and from like a typically a discretionary trader perspective, sort of that long vol bias. I remember like DRW has sort of they do really well in sort of those tail environments. I like to call it cowboy Christmas, with where things break and systematic strategies no longer work. A discretionary trader or someone with a lot of trading experience, those are usually really, really good times. So that's kind of cool to hear that Wintermute has sort of kind of had that same type of experience. Speaking of like crazy tail risk events and scenarios, I recently read this idea of potential sell side liquidity crisis in Bitcoin. The idea is, if these ETFs keep accumulating Bitcoin, who's going to be at the other side to essentially sell Bitcoin as the float keeps diminishing and diminishing, and prices could theoretically go crazy. Have you heard of this scenario or this thesis? And if so, do you have any thoughts or ideas about it?
We were joking on this so-called, OTC desk. I only have 40 Bitcoins left a few maybe a month and a half ago. That was a good joke as such, that I don't think there's any science behind it. I think what's interesting in that flow is a bit different than the total amount. I don't think we're just going to suddenly run out of BTC. I'm less concerned about this than I'm a bit. I find it's interesting that people, if you just go back 2020, 2021, or early 2021, people used to complain that Bitcoin was very Chinese. Do you remember this? Because a lot of the miners were there, and then basically, like China, basically closed the doors to the miners, and then a lot of them went to Canada and so on, and to a few other geographies. But now people should probably complain that Bitcoin is too American. Because it literally like most of the custody is done by Coinbase. I think Bullish does a bit of it, but it's very, very concentrated with American actors actually. So it's interesting to see how we do get an Americanization of through this institutionalization of or through the ETF, we just get an Americanization of Bitcoin. So I don't know. I don't necessarily think that, you know, it follows the original, you know, Bitcoiners philosophy as such. It's kind of part of the game to get better price discovery. You want the smartest people around the table. So you want, you know, you want retail, you want your institutions and so on. But it's true that it's interesting to see that, yeah, the consequence is definitely an Americanization of Bitcoin. Lacking inventory, I think we've got some time to see. I think this just ends up, it's, you know, it's functionalized enough. Like it should, like if you generally have a view that the supply is going to lack, then you should just be long part out of it.
Sure.
Essentially, that's the only answer. That's the only answer if you just follow your thought a bit further. I mean, maybe you didn't want to say it, you wanted me to say it, but that's the only conclusion.
Yeah. And that's a really good point about sort of the Americanization. We saw this really in 2023, starting October, around sort of the news of the ETF, you know, coming up, potentially getting approved. We saw open interest in CME futures actually, you know, exceed Binance. It still exceeds Binance today. Binance used to be the biggest player. So we kind of, and then we saw like BitO, even that CME futures Bitcoin ETF, that started getting growth in options open interest. The growth rate was bigger than Deribit, not the absolute rate, but we saw kind of a lot of U.S. players come online. So it's kind of interesting to see that.
There's an aspect that people don't mention a lot is that I think there's more institutional exposure, you know, not necessarily Bitcoin itself, but actually through crypto space, through a lot of VC funds. So the VC tends to be first, and institutionalization, if you think of institutionalization cycle tends to just, you know, start with more VCs because they can take the risk of losing everything essentially. Then macro, and then, you know, essentially, like if you start to see some more quality long short hedge funds in the space, then you really have much more maturity as such. But it's, you know, I think there's been some institutional money there. And a lot of it comes from pension plan, you know, pension funds and so on. And a lot of this is American money, to be honest.
Yeah.
So there's some impact there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Awesome. Yeah. Well, usually I like to wrap up the interview with a couple of personal questions. So I think the first question would be, you know, what do you like to do outside of work for fun?
I do tend to work 24/7. I spend time with family, and then I'm a bit of a language geek when I'm still trying to find time somehow to learn a bit more Korean.
Oh wow!
But I like just, you know, just study and maintain and just to do some geeky cultural sort of pastime as such. But yeah.
That's very cool.
Sorry.
And then last question here. This is really interesting, especially given your kind of vast background. Do you have any books that helped you along the way, either on your trading career or your founder's career, that you like to recommend, or some favorite books?
So I like, I don't have favorite books as such, apart from like more, I tend to read books to actually turn my brain off.
I see.
I tend to think that people, like, so it's more that I love, I think. It's a very good question. I have some favorite books as such, but which are just nothing to do with, like, you know, sort of training or treat, like, there's a Miyazawa Kenji book. That's my favorite book. That's basically, so it's a Japanese book, so it's Jingatetsu no Yoru, which is means essentially the Galactic Railroad as such, or the Night of the Galactic Railroad.
Oh wow.
Which is, you should just it's worth learning Japanese for it. It's
a wow. very, very good book.
So I think it's from 1938, and it just talks about life and death and everything, and so it's pretty good. Sadly this writer just died in his 30s or something, got pneumonia. Could have like written a lot, many more books, and hopefully would have been as good. But yeah, that's one. So I tend to read more like, yeah, as I said, just more like fantasy or sci-fi as such.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, to learn Japanese to read the book, that's pretty high marks. I just came back from Japan for the fourth time, and I'm still stuck on only a few words. I gotta learn some Japanese.
But in that book, the language is pretty rich. You can learn how to say "all of a sudden" in five different ways in Japanese.
Oh,
and
wow!
I'm barely joking. So I had to read. I think I wrote it. I did about five times or so. And then, yeah, you need a bit of a dictionary on the side, but, no, I think people as just reading books is more like, I think let's, I'll try to give you some insight. I think a few things that I've found useful were like, things that help you to see the world a bit differently. So maybe some Malcolm Gladwell, you know, the classic Gladwell, like Outliers or something.
Mm, yeah.
Like respecting, you know, sort of like the stats, understanding stats better, I think is just really useful in life.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of risk taking, I think it's useful. I think in terms of being open to not being like, I think it's more just better thinking in terms of like managing. So in trading, you learn this a lot. So managing ego as such. So you need to be aggressive enough so you actually take, you know, make decisions, but you have a lot of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
So respecting that, you know, respecting the fact that, I was trying to flesh this out on Twitter the other day. And I think the only good way to phrase it is that you learn how to trust your ability to learn and you're confident in yourself because you have your ability to learn, but you shouldn't be married to your positions. You're not confident necessarily in your opinions.
Yeah.
And it just gives you a flexibility to just be like thinking or say, oh, I'm understanding that I can adapt. And I can, I know enough to adapt and adapt, you know, admittedly and hopefully faster than competitors. But essentially beyond that, you don't get too married to opinions. You don't get, I think it's basically where the ego should be placed. So it's more this, but if I can advise anything to anyone, is just do some morning walks and thinking and so on, just on the sea. Don't necessarily spend.
I love
reading
it.
Is just reading someone else's thoughts, and the thing is just thinking just is actually a good thing, and not be close to opportunities. I think there's people typically in life that can be super helpful. Like, you know, 10 years later, you don't necessarily know, like and they can be quite transformative. So I think it's just always good to respect, you know, anyone, depend, you know, regardless of where they come from in life, and just see what you can learn from them.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Yo, well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really honored. I had a great time chatting with you, and I think we learned a lot. So thank you so much.
Thank you. That's
absolutely.
Great.